On a Monday, we're getting up to speed on developments inside the halls of the state capitol. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We'll take developments one at a time, starting with the swearing-in of Supreme Court Justice Brian Hagedorn for a 10-year term. After that, we'll move on to a lawsuit challenging Governor Evers' partial vetoes of the state budget. So lots to discuss with your questions, your insights as we go. 800-642-1234. What do you think of the ideological makeup of the state Supreme Court and what it means for the cases in the future? What about the litigation over the governor's veto power? Do you think it's justified? We're at 800-642-1234. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, and she co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So Judge Brian Hagedorn was sworn into the state Supreme Court Thursday. Justice Hagedorn will serve 10 years, 10-year term. What is the significance of his presence on the court?
So this is a big deal for conservatives because Justice Hagedorn is a conservative-backed candidate. He received a lot of support from conservative organizations during the campaign. And his swearing-in brings the partisan makeup of the court to 5-2 in favor of conservatives. So I spoke with a professor emeritus at the UW-Milwaukee, a frequent commenter on political science in Wisconsin, Mordecai Lee. And he talked a little bit about sort of the implications of that big of a majority for conservatives on the court.
This is a kind of a comfort level that gives conservatives a feeling that no matter what, they're always going to have a viable majority.
So basically what he was saying there is that one justice could, you know, I think what he said was go rogue or sort of go off the reservation or whatever, maybe not agree with other conservative justices on a particular case. Mm. They could sort of decide to not be with the majority opinion and conservatives would still have the majority in cases. So it gives those individuals of that particular ideology just a little bit more room to kind of disagree with each other potentially and have a safe majority in cases.
And it was reportedly the most expensive state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin history. How much money was spent on this race?
So $3.7 million was spent in the state Supreme Court race. That is a full $1 million more than the last record, which was coincidentally set at the previous state Supreme Court race. So we're pretty steadily
building.
Yeah, these races are getting more expensive. And as we've said many times, more partisan. That's becoming kind of an emergent theme in these Supreme Court races. So perhaps there's a little bit of a, you know, relationship there in terms of the money and the partisanship.
Another election for an incumbent seat will happen next April. What do we see there?
So this is a particularly interesting Supreme Court race because this is the re-election bid by conservative Justice Daniel Kelly, who was appointed to the court in 2016. It's particularly interesting because it's falling on the same day as the Democratic presidential primary. So a lot of political watchers believe that just the timing of that election will benefit the liberal-backed candidates.
Oh, there could be more traffic at the polls.
Exactly. Democratic voters tend to turn up more in presidential election years. It's obviously a Democratic presidential primary. So having this officially nonpartisan state Supreme Court race on the ballot when a lot of Democrats are showing up at the polls, they think, well, maybe that's going to help the liberal-backed candidate. This was something that people were looking kind of toward in the last Supreme Court race, because if Hagedorn hadn't won, this 2020 race coming up would have been an opportunity actually for liberals to take the majority of the court for the first time since 2011, I believe. Obviously, that's not the case. That election would just take it back to 4-3 if the liberal-backed candidate did win. But that's sort of setting it up down the line for potentially a change in the ideological balance of the court.
Do we know who is running against Justice Kelly?
So we do have two liberal candidates already announced, a Milwaukee law professor, a professor at Marquette, Ed Filone, and then a Dane County judge, Jill Karofsky, are both running.
So what happens next with Judge Hagedorn being on the court? What case will be before him first?
So I don't know off the top of my head what case will be before him first, but I do know that there are a number of big cases headed to the state Supreme Court. I think one we're going to talk about a little bit later has to do with the governor's veto powers. Mm-hmm. There's a strong possibility that the legislative maps in Wisconsin could end up before the state Supreme Court when they're drawn in 2021. So lots of big issues that are going to be heading to the court, certainly during Judge Hagedorn's tenure, Justice Hagedorn's tenure.
We're moving through developments at the state capitol with Laurel White. She is WPR's state capitol reporter. Democratic lawmakers are circulating bills that aim to have gun stores store their products in secure places after hours. Do you think this is a positive move, or do you think it won't do much to improve safety? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Moving on to this lawsuit, a conservative group called the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty filed a suit Wednesday over Governor Evers' veto powers. What is Will alleging?
So essentially what Will is saying in this lawsuit is that the governor's vetoes, particularly four of his vetoes, they singled out those four of the 78 that he issued, were just too far-reaching, too broad, had too much of a effect, should you say, on the legislative language. They said that basically what he did in their estimation was not alter the language that the legislature passed, but rather created new laws entirely. Hmm. They had a Capitol press conference about this, and this is how their president, Rick Essenberg, described the governor's vetoes.
Here we have what I might call a magician's veto, in which appropriation items that have been passed by the legislature have been transformed magically into something else.
It's pretty powerful, a magician's veto.
So we know that vetoes in Wisconsin get these snazzy names sometimes. We have the Vanna White veto that was outlawed, the Frankenstein veto. And so I think this is obviously an attempt by Will to kind of label this what they believe to be a new veto, which is a contentious subject in and of itself.
I don't know why it wasn't called the Harry Potter veto, right?
Right. You might need a little trademark, you know, a little suit from Warner Brothers or something if you mention that.
So, you know, why is Governor Evers' veto pen unique and powerful?
So the Wisconsin governor does have one of the most powerful veto pens in the country. You know, he can remove things, add things, words, punctuation, numbers. So, you know, obviously we mentioned some of those things that have been rolled back. The Vanna White veto, that was taking out individual letters and words. The Frankenstein veto, taking out words in adjacent sentences to make new sentences. So the powers have been trimmed back over the years. But certainly the Wisconsin governor does still maintain a strong veto. I think it's interesting to note kind of the pushback on this lawsuit from Democrats, and that is that the vetoes that Governor Evers put forward aren't substantially different, they believe, in substance from the vetoes that, say, Governor Walker put forward. They're saying, we believe Governor Walker's vetoes had the same sort of effect in terms of the amount of change that they put in place. That's and Will actually kind of acknowledged that during the press conference when they were rolling out this lawsuit. They said, we acknowledge other governors have done that before, but this isn't a partisan lawsuit in our belief. We are just kind of pushing back to preserve what they called, you know, the balance of powers, the separation of powers. They said, we haven't had the capacity to bring this lawsuit before. This is just the time that we're doing it, but it's not about personalities or politics. It's about the principle of the thing.
Let's bring in David now in DeForest. Hi, David.
Hi. I wanted to ask that these laws and rules that they're challenging now, much like the lame duck rules, aren't these all rules that the Republicans first enacted in the first place?
So they're not rules that the Republicans enacted entirely, but I think you're kind of hitting on that theme a little bit that Democrats have talked about a lot and others have talked about as this lawsuit has come out, which is that Republican governors have certainly done the same things that Governor Evers did with his veto pen that this lawsuit is challenging. And that's something that the group bringing the lawsuit acknowledges. This isn't really a Democratic thing or a Republican thing. All governors have done this. They just believe that now's the time to kind of rein that in. I would really strongly suggest anybody that's interested in vetoes in Wisconsin and the history of vetoes to look up a report done, I think it was 2 months ago now. It was in June by the Legislative Reference Bureau. And they actually outline the different vetoes that different governors have done over time. So you can sort of compare and see what governors have done and the magnitude of their changes, things like that. It's interesting.
Well, let's move on to gun storage. A package of bills is being circulated by Democratic lawmakers related to gun storage. One of those bills is centered on the way businesses store the guns they sell. What is this legislation? Can you tell us about it?
So this is a package of bills sponsored primarily by Representative Lisa Subek in the Assembly and Senator Fred Risser in the Senate. Those are both Madison area lawmakers. And I think kind of the biggest bill that rises to the top of this package, and I identify that because it's a bill that was first introduced during the last legislative session and actually got a hearing during that session, which is an indication that it might move forward in the legislative process. This is a bill that would require gun stores of all sizes across the state to lock up the guns after closing time. And this is in response to, I believe it was in 2016, there was that break-in at a Janesville gun store where an individual stole 18 weapons, and a number of those haven't been recovered yet. That led to a several-day manhunt across Wisconsin trying to find this individual. Representative Subek said that the legislation was in response to incidents like that and just sort of an overall culture of gun violence in the country.
We're moving through developments at the state capitol with WPR reporter who keeps tabs on it all. Laurel White is here. Lawmakers have clashed over funding for mental health support for farmers. Does this issue hit home for you? And what about the issue over guns? Would you see that this legislation would make an impact? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the State Capitol Report, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democratic lawmakers are circulating bills that aim to have gun stores store their products in secure places after hours. Do you think this is a positive move, or do you think it won't do much to improve safety? Join in at 800-642-1234. WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Carol joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
My opinion on the guns is that a more central issue is conceal and carry. I am opposed. I think they should be opposed to conceal and carry because more people think that other people have guns now, so they think, I better go out and get a gun too, or I'm going to be in danger. So many people would be influenced if there were legislative action against conceal and carry.
Carol, thanks so much for calling in. Laurel, what do we see on that front?
Well, that's certainly something that we know that the Republican majority in Wisconsin is in strong favor of concealed carry in Wisconsin. So I think it would take a major sort of ideological shift for the party for that to change while Republicans still have the majority in the state legislature in Wisconsin. And we know that they have, particularly in the state assembly, a very strong majority that's likely to last for a while.
Well, going back to this gun storage legislation, where we left off, Democratic Representative Lisa Subek, you talked to her, and let's take a listen.
We have an epidemic of gun violence. And in too many instances, we're hearing about people who are already prohibited from owning a firearm, getting a hold of weapons and doing harm with them.
So is this what her bill is in response to, getting a hold of weapons?
That's right. So I think I mentioned this before our break, but there was that incident in Janesville, and it was in 2017 where those 18 weapons were stolen from a Janesville gun store. There have been other incidents, you know, across the state where individuals break in and they're able to abscond with multiple weapons. It's obviously a way for individuals who aren't licensed to have a gun, who aren't able to legally have a gun in Wisconsin, to get their hands on those. So she believes that that's a way to just kind of put up another barrier.
What type of traction is she getting? What kind of support is this bill seeing right now?
So I didn't get a response from the leaders in the state legislature, either the assembly or the Senate. I also reached out to a number of Wisconsin gun groups to see if they wanted to weigh in on this proposal or other proposals in the package. They declined to do so, but we did get a statement from the National Rifle Association, which was pretty strongly opposed to this measure, as well as others. They called it a one-size-fits-all approach. I think their biggest argument against it was they didn't think that it was fair or appropriate for Milwaukee gun stores or gun stores in larger urban areas to have the same sort of requirements as smaller, more rural stores that might not have the same quantity of product or the same means to be able to provide these secure facilities.
So this legislation is a package of bills. What else is in the package?
Mm-hmm. So there's another provision. Actually, we got some input from the NRA on this one as well, that would require people who have a child in the home, if they have a gun, to lock up the gun in their at their property as well. So just some additional requirements for storage. Also some requirements for if a weapon is stolen, how long you have to report it, things like that. I think there are five bills in all in the package.
Have we seen this legislation before?
Yes, this is all legislation that was introduced for the first time during the last legislative session, but there was only one bill that received a hearing, and that was the storage in stores legislation, but it didn't make it very far in the process after that.
And I'm sure we'll be watching this very closely given the traumatic events this weekend.
Absolutely. This is a very timely discussion, and I think it's something that we're going to be hearing a lot about moving forward.
Let's look at mental health services for farmers, a program to help homeless people also gain job skills. What are these proposals trying to do?
So these are two different proposals that were actually approved as part of the state budget. So they are provisions that provide funding to different state agencies for different programs. The Farmer Mental Health Program is about $200,000 that goes to an entity that has been doing outreach to farmers for quite a while about a variety of issues. But this would kind of beef up the work that they do surrounding mental health, which is something that farmers and agriculture groups have said is sorely needed now as the industry faces some challenges. The homeless job training is a program. It's a skills-based program that provides homeless individuals with training so they might be able to seek employment in certain areas. Now, again, these are things that were approved as part of the state budget, but what's kind of wonky is that some elements of the budget have to go back to the state budget writing committee for another layer of approval before they're released to these departments. So these are two of those things. It's kind of I would say a bit more than a handful, sort of two handfuls maybe, of this kind of program. And they went back to the budget committee just a couple weeks ago. And the reason that they're in the news is that they weren't approved at that time. There's been a little bit of a delay in getting these funds released.
Well, since there's so much focus right now on what is happening this past weekend with the 29 deaths and the deadly shooting, let's bring in Carol in Fish Creek with some observations. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm so dispersed by our lawmakers. I think so it's such a huge common sense thing. Lock the guns up at the store, lock the guns up at home, and if you have a gun stolen, report it. You're not hurting the people who want guns. You're saving the people who could be hurt by guns. And any lawmaker who doesn't want to take that common sense step, vote them out.
Karen, thanks for calling in. So Karen really feels this legislation is pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that, you know, as we mentioned before, this is obviously going to be an ongoing conversation in the state capitol. There have been other pieces of legislation other than this package that we're talking about today that have been introduced related to guns in Wisconsin. People that are interested in this particular new package, as I mentioned, that's Representative Subek from Madison, Senator Risser, from Madison. I think that this isn't a conversation that's going to end anytime soon.
Well, let's look at Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who took some heat after he declined to allow Democratic Representative Jimmy Anderson the ability to phone into committee meetings. What happened there last week?
So Speaker Voss, this is a conflict that's been going on for a couple weeks, but last week Speaker Voss released a letter in response to Representative Anderson's request saying that he wasn't going to meet it. He said that he has some concerns about lawmakers being able to call into legislative meetings because he believes it's disrespectful to members of the public that come in to testify on bills. So he said that that's a policy that's applicable to the state assembly that he believes should stay in place. However, he was willing to explore some other accommodations for Representative Anderson, including allowing some lawmakers to vote by paper ballot for committee meetings, which means you can vote remotely. You don't have to be physically present to vote on a bill for a committee. He also said that he was willing to arrange a videographer for the representative to come in and film these meetings and provide that tape to him so he was able to watch the meetings he couldn't attend. Representative Anderson is paralyzed from the chest down, so he says that that disability makes it difficult for him to sit for long periods of time to attend some of these meetings. But he said that Representative Anderson said some of these provisions that Speaker Voss proposed really aren't satisfactory. He said that the videotaping offer is particularly troublesome because it wouldn't allow him to interact during the meeting. He wouldn't be able to ask any questions of members of the public that come in to testify. He wouldn't be able to talk with other lawmakers during this process. So he said essentially that's kind of reducing him to a bystander at this committee meeting rather than the sort of active lawmaker participant role he wants to play.
Laurel, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Just ahead, we talk about the free and reduced lunch program and disparities in the program across the state. And stay with us after 9 for coverage of the deadly weekend shootings in El Paso and Dayton. On Point, we'll start our coverage after 9. 1A, we'll continue it after 1. We hear from you about what you're thinking and feeling after a deadly week in our country. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.